We started with St. Thomas, Tommy Flanagan on piano. That's all we have.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, we are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. The latest season watch pod with hosts Charlie Mitchell, Heidi Holton, John Latimer, and a rotating cast of characters is out. This week, a look at cranes and northern lights. Season watch pod. For the curious, filled with the delights of nature. New podcast Thursdays. The mountain bike trails at Tioga Recreation Area near Cohasset will be closed now through November 23rd due to deer hunting. Itasca Housing Resource Team hosts Soup on the Street Wednesday, November 19th on the grounds of Old Central School in Grand Rapids from 3 to 5 p.m. Stand in solidarity with those experiencing housing insecurity and hunger. Donations of hats, mittens, and scarves will be accepted, and soup will be served.
Let's take a boat to Bermuda.
Let's take a plane to St. Paul.
Let's take a kayak to Quincy or Nyack. Let's get away from it all. Let's take a trip in a trailer.
No need to come back at all.
Let's take a partner to Boston for charter. Away from it all.
We'll travel around from town to town. We'll visit every state. I'll repeat, I love you, sweet, in all the 48.
How many? Let's take a trip to Niagara.
This time we'll look at the
Let's leave our hut, dear.
Get out of our rut, dear. Let's get away from it all.
Hi, friends. It's time for an hour of story and song. On today's show, we're traveling through Africa, on the grand tour of Europe, into the wilds of Manhattan, and booking trips for groups of friends. Come along with us and stay human.
We'll travel around from town to town and visit every state. I'll repeat, I love you, sweet, in all the 48.
You mean 50? Let's go again to Niagara.
This time we'll look at the falls.
Let's leave a hot deal. Get out of the rut, dear.
Let's get away from it all.
Our first teller today up at Deer Lake likes to travel with her friends. And of course, the planning can sometimes be an even bigger deal than the trip itself. Here's Gail Blackmer.
I got a group of friends up there, and yeah, walking is great. We like to walk and like to travel. So a couple of years ago, this group of women started talking about taking a hiking and a camping trip, which is easy to talk about. And so word went around, oh, where should we go? Well, somebody threw a dart or in some reason decided that terrific classic hiking trail, the Appalachian Trail, which went Maine to Georgia. It's one of the three great hiking trails in the United States. So, of course, it's the challenge that these women wanted to take. Well, let's do it. And when we started out, it was a group of probably about eight women. Well, as time went on, dropped out for one reason or another. Somebody thought, nah, my back won't take it. Somebody else got a little spooked when they heard that someone was murdered on the trail. And me, I just had a total knee replacement. So I didn't think I could go on it. No, I'm not going to be able to go on this. So I watched from the sidelines. Well, the others started getting ready. And in came the maps, of course, and the Facebook groups and the studying and the books. So that went on and on. And then it started getting ready to pack. So you look at the trail, 2,000 miles, maybe we can do 5 miles a day. Well, we're not doing 2,000, but we can maybe do 5 miles a day. That's pretty easy. So start practicing hiking, mile, couple of miles, 3 miles and back. Of course, I still had the bum knee. I'm not walking. I still didn't think I'd be able to go. So they're practicing and they're getting in shape and they're starting to order the goods. And of course you need good quality boots. Why wouldn't you? You need a hiking stick. And now the hiking sticks range from the highest synthetic material to a stick, which people had said they cut a stick. Well, no, they had to get the high quality sticks. And then you look at your rest of your gear. You got to have a rain suit. You got to have a hat. You got to have a shovel to cover up your morning potty break. You've got to have cooking gear. You got to have a sleeping bag. You got to have a mat. You got to have a tent. And so out come the catalogs. Out go the online shopping. And these girls are chasing back and forth with the lightest, the least expensive, the best deal. But you got to have all that stuff. So this goes on for one full year. Then I had my surgery, and the trip got planned for 90 days later. And I says, I can do it. Sure, let me come. Well, they had all the gear, you know, down to the cooking pot that boiled water in 90 seconds, but of course it's only one cup for one person, so everybody's got to have their own. Now we need the food and freeze-dried stuff, but weight is everything. You know, you got to cut the labels off your tea bags because you can't have an extra ounce, and you got to pack it in a backpack. So we're trading around. Well, I ended up, if I'm going to go 90 days post-surgery, I'm doing my exercises, and I got the clearance from the doctor, but I'm pretty spooked about keeping up. And I borrow poles and boots and backpack and something else, rain jacket. I borrowed about half my gear. So we pack up, finally hit the road. First, now we got to drive from Minnesota to wherever we're going to start, state of Virginia, Shenandoah National Forest. We chose that because that section is, well, maybe one of the easier ones. It's not quite so up and down for you know, lots of elevation changes. And it's got good views. So we drive it now. Now we got a road trip, too. We're down to 4 women by this time, me included with my, you know, brand new knee. And a puppy. And, somebody had a puppy, so we got a 2-month-old puppy. That's got to come too. And the puppy gets its own backpack because it's got to carry its feed. And it's got to have a collapsible water bowl so you can pack it. Anyhow, we're on the road, so it's a road trip too. We get there finally after 2 days and finding motels that take a puppy. And we enter the Shenandoah National Park. And by here, I'm thinking it's wilderness. There's signs saying bear, you know, country. Must have food contained, all of that. And then there's another sign that says Washington, D.C., 80 miles. Couldn't believe it, but beautiful country. But we get there, and now we're meeting up with the fourth woman, who is driving now after a year in planning. Even though she sold her home and moved, she wasn't going to miss this trip she'd been planning and spending money on and practicing for and packing. So she's coming from Colorado. But we do. We meet up in the Shenandoah National Park, exact stated hour. Jill is hiking down the trail, and she meets us at a parking lot. And she's carrying her pack. And suddenly we're realizing how hard it is to hike with a pack. She's made it, but we're all looking. She's telling us this was not that much fun. Okay, well, let's go to, find a spot where we can start. By this time, we've all tried on our packs, and all right, around 38 pounds, we all put it on our backs and stand there, look at each other. Can't, you know, we've got visions of going through the woods and finding a little spot to kick away the brush and set up our camps and then pack up in the morning and head off again for our next 5-mile stretch. And, you know, along comes a national campground, and we pull in, and we pick up one of the last two or three spots, and we set up camp. And the next day, we take our fanny packs with a few granola bars, a little water, some, you know, sunscreen, and have a great time doing day trips, coming back to the camp at night, making a fire. Boy, was that a good decision, to stand there looking at each other with 40-pound packs on our back and knowing we're not going to, I could not have taken a step on that knee, uh-uh. So down we camped, and camping was fun too.
My thanks to Gail Blackmer, all respect to her and her crew, and to the many intrepid Nobo and Sobo thru-hikers who actually do that Appalachian Trail.
Two little feet to get me across the mountain. Two little feet to carry me away into the woods. Two little feet to make a mountain. Cloud coming down, cloud coming down, cloud coming down, cloud coming down. I hear the voice of the ancient ones chanting magic words from a different time. Well, there is no time, there is only this rain. There is no time, that's why I missed my plane. John Muir walked away into the mountains in his old overcoat, a crust of bread in his pocket. We have no knowledge, and so we have stuff. And stuff with no knowledge is never enough to get you there. Just won't get you there. The culture exploded into knick-knacks and memories. Eagle and bear trinkets, I don't think it's good. Oh man, what am I trying to say? It's a messed up world, but I love it anyway, I love it. Get me across the city, my little hand to knock upon your door, my little thing for your little thing, big love to lift us up once more to the mountain, lift us up, lift us up. Tumble us like scree, let us holler at our freedom like a wolf across the valley, like a kid lost in a game. No time, no name. Gonna miss that plane again. I'm gonna stay here with you, baby, and kiss you to a good dream. I'm gonna kiss you. I'm gonna kiss you. Kiss you like you like it. Kiss you like you like it. Kiss you like you like it. I got two little feet to get me across the mountain. Two little feet to carry me away into the woods. Two little feet, a bigger mountain than a cloud coming down, cloud coming down, cloud coming down, cloud coming down. Cloud coming down. Two little feet. A big mountain. Two little feet. A big mountain. Two little a bigger mount.
Greg Brown on Stay Human. I'm Michael Goldberg, and I don't always get to go all the places I want to go, but I do have a lot of friends who tell me about their travels. Of course, each one of their stories makes me think of one of mine or gives me an idea for some future trip. We've been invited out to Ashland, Oregon for an 80th birthday party next summer, and I've never been to Ashland, and 80, you know, so yeah, we're going. But our host really, really wants us to bring our grandchildren, too, to play with his grandchildren. And I don't know about that. That would make it a pretty different trip. Coming up, we've got a couple of stories of traveling with family. First, in Bemidji, here's poet and storyteller Marsh Muirhead.
When our family was young, my father's idea of a vacation was to camp in stinging rain on the shore of Lake Winnie for the fishing opener, or to stay in a cigarette smoke-filled cabin in the woods for those frigid and gray November days during deer hunting. Late in life, Mother decided to engage in real travel, leaving Dad at home, taking me along as guide and concierge, sometimes with my Aunt Marge, Mother's sister, or Mother's granddaughter, my niece, Amy. Celebrating Amy's graduation from college, Mother and I took her to England, where my mother's people came from, the Shepherds and the Braithwaites. While visiting the London Zoo's aquarium, Mother gazed into a large tank swimming with various creatures, but was transfixed by a large, roundish, green thing, scaly, rather feathered, suspended near the surface. She was shaking her head in wonder and called us over. "Look at this thing," she said to us. "What on earth?" "It's a head of lettuce," Amy said, "food for the fishes." A night later, we had exited the theater after seeing The Lion King. Trying to hail a cab, Mother stood at the curb, swinging her purse. Nobody stopped. "You look like a madwoman," I said. "They know we're Americans," she said. I convinced her to step back into the shadows and sent Amy to the curb. Immediately, one of those iconic black cabs screeched to a halt. Mother darted past us through the open door, hitting her head. "I thought he might leave me behind," she said. Mother could be prone to assumptions and misapprehensions. The three of us were in a centuries-old pub out near Bath, adjacent to our quaint hotel. After a second pint, Mother became loquacious and quite opinionated, her passion and observations in full bloom. How low the doorways and ceilings, how well-dressed and elegant the local elderly men were, so conversationally intelligent, her ancestors. She suddenly remembered that we were out of toilet paper in our hotel room and waved a server over. "Something else?" he said. "We are out of toilet paper," she announced. "I'm sorry," he said, then looked at Amy and me. We reminded Mother the pub was next to but not part of the hotel. "Yes," the server said, "you'll need to take that up with your hotel desk." Same trip. A day later, we were at the back of a crowd watching some acrobatic buskers perform gymnastics on the plaza of another hotel. Two wiry young men, wearing nothing but G-strings, were doing backflips and handstands on each other's shoulders. Mother's naughty streak kicked in, and she pressed forward, swinging her purse, parting the crowd like Moses parting the sea, encouraging us to move to the front, take pictures. I did. The photo I still have is a view showing Mother, clutching that purse, looking up at the one man doing a handstand on the shoulders of the other, a lit sparkler sticking out from his butt cheeks. On another trip with Aunt Marge, part of a tour of Central Europe with a mix of European and American tourists, we stopped in a village in France for lunch, a quick in-and-out place catering to busloads. Once seated, it was announced that the special was beefsteak, biff. After ordering that, Marge told us that, knowing we were from the United States, they would serve us horse meat. "Nonsense," I said. "We're a mix of English, Canadians, Germans. They have no way of knowing or caring." Marge insisted they'd know. Mother, now convinced, tapped the passing waiter's hip and queried, "Biff? Biff?" "Oui," he said. Mother waved on another waiter. "Biff? Biff? Si," she said, mixing languages. We were all served what looked to be the same, boeuf, not cheval. 2 days later, Marge came down with the flu, blaming it on the horse meat, and went to bed. While she remained in bed, Mother and I boarded the bus for a wine tasting in a small German winery. where, our guide told us, we would experience a variety of vocal vintages accompanied by selected meats and fine cheeses. Like school children, we were led in a line to our seats at long, narrow tables. A door behind us was slammed rather loudly, and the hall was nearly windowless. A somewhat stern set of servers first portioned out the promised meats, which Mother kept remarking were quite fatty, head cheese and liverwurst among the many fine cheeses. The wine glasses were small, the local wine unremarkable, the amount stingy. Out of the blue, and too loud to be missed by our companions and a few of the servers, Mother turned to me and said, "I can see how these people became Nazis." With her quirky opinions and observations, her good humor and naughty streak, our travels were some of the best years of my mother's life. I remember leaning into the wind while sailing in a three-masted schooner in Key West. Her wide-eyed wonder on a flight in a small plane to the base camp at Denali in Alaska. How much she enjoyed a raucous, low-country boil on the Outer Banks of North Carolina at a cousin's wedding. Mother was very definite and assured in her Christian beliefs. She lived to be 91, and in her final days in hospice, she said she was ready to go, ready to leave to that other country. At the end, she was rarely conscious, but on the day before she died, she woke briefly, looked around, looked at us, and then said, "Am I still here?" "Yes," we said. "Oh, shit," she said, then closed her eyes for the last time.
Thanks to Marsh Muirhead. I'm glad he got to take those trips with his mother before she traveled on without him. Here's Etta James.
Some glad morning when this life's over.
I'll fly away
to a home on God's celestial shore.
I'll fly away.
Oh,
I'll fly away.
We'll fly away.
I'll fly away.
Oh,
I'll fly away.
We'll fly away.
I'll fly away.
When I die, hallelujah, by and by. Oh,
I'll fly away.
Just a few more weary days and then
I'll fly away.
To a land where joy shall never end.
I'll fly away.
Oh,
I'll fly away.
We'll fly away.
I'll fly away.
Oh, yeah.
I'll fly away.
We'll fly away.
I'll fly away.
Oh,
when I die, hallelujah,
bye bye.
I'll fly away.
When the shadows of this life are gone, hey,
I'll fly away.
Like a bird from the prison bars I've flown,
I'll fly away.
Oh,
I'll fly away.
It's words and music for Spirit and Courage every week on Stay Human. Today, we have a few of the stories that come from traveling, especially with people you love. Up next, Bemidji storyteller Leif Wallin.
And the phone rings, and my wife Karen answers, and she hears my son call. "Mom, cancel the credit cards. We killed Osama bin Laden." Not exactly the statement I was telling Cole when I told Cole to call your mother. Okay, a little bit of backstory on this one. Cole goes to a middle school in South Minneapolis, and they have an annual trip to Europe. And that's just wrong. One, they're too young. If you go to Europe, it's got to be at least college, late high school, so you can experience everything about it. Plus, most of these kids, they're closer to the poverty line than the let's go to Europe line. So we knew we had to give Cole an alternative. Cole, you're not going to go on the trip to Europe. But as an alternative, I'm going to give you a father-son trip to New York City. And he was like, oh, that's so cool. Don't believe it. He was pissed. I mean, I can't go with my buddies. I just got to go with dumb old dad. Yes. Well, I gave him some books and he started reading them. And I think he kind of realized reality sets in and there's no way he's going to get around that. The day before we left, I said, okay, Cole, pack your bags. We're going to be gone for about 8 days. So he packed his bags. The next day we head off to the airport and we're in the line where they check your bags. And this big dude ends up getting in between Cole and I. I set my bag down. The agent, it's fine, goes on. Looks at that big dude. I hear him, pulls up his microphone. I need assistance here at lane number two. Assistance, please, lane number two. Looks at that big dude and says, is that your bag? Big dude says, not my bag. And then Cole shows his smile with his grill of braces on his teeth and says, that's my bag? The agent opens it up and pulls out a chain, a padlock, and a screwdriver. But Dad, it's for my bike lock. Did you see us bringing your bike to the airport? Well, after about an hour discussion with the TSA agents, we finally got on our way to the plane, minus a chain, padlock, and a screwdriver. But we got to New York, and it was great. The first day, though, it was really rainy, and so there wasn't a whole lot to do. So New York is known for the New York-style pizzas. So we just found a New York-style pizza parlor, and we greased our way to happiness. As the days commenced, we did Central Park. We did the Museum of Modern Art, which was an experience. We look at the Museum of Modern Art, and like, there's a bowling alley in the corner with a golf club, and that's art? You kind of wonder about some of this stuff. Then you turn the corner and there's something from Pablo Picasso and you just look at it and go like, that is incredible, amazing. Well, we kept at it and we're getting towards the last day. Now, when we left, I told Cole, I really want to see a Broadway show, a musical. Not high on the list of the average eighth grader. And then he found out that there is a new one called The Book of Mormon. And it was done by the same group that did the South Park show, South Park on Comedy Central, the kids show. And Cole said, oh, I guess I could do that. So we watched that show and it was great music and it was hilarious. We all laughed. And when the cast broke out a couple of F-bombs, oh, that was icing on the cake for Cole. Anyway, so now we're heading back to the hotel and we're about halfway there. And Cole looks up at me and he says, hey, Dad, why don't we stop at that coffee shop? I'll have a hot chocolate and you can have a coffee and we'll just hang out. Oh, father, son, I felt so good about that little statement. So we did that. And then we headed back and we finally got back to the hotel and we get ready for bed and I flip on the television and like there's 100 channels, but there's news on every single channel. And I slow down, I'm gonna see what they're saying. I pause it. And the announcer says, Osama bin Laden has been caught and killed. And there is a spontaneous gathering at the site of the World Trade Towers that went down under his command. And Cole looked at me and he said, can we go? And I knew he was expecting me. I would say, no way, Cole, it's almost midnight. It's past your bedtime. But I said, no, we cannot miss this. So we put our clothes on. We get out the front door. And I look back and he's wearing flip-flops, a t-shirt and shorts. Cole, it's cold out there. It's late in that night. Put some clothes on. He runs back in, puts some clothes on. And we're running towards the subway stop because we're about three subway stops away. And And I see a train coming, just see the train coming. I try to pull out my subway pass and I can't find it. I pull it out of my wallet. And just at the last minute, I find the pass, put it in the turnstile. We jump through, get onto the train. And then I look back and there's my credit card has fallen on the platform. And this young gentleman picks it up and gives me a smile. And that's the point where I said, Cole, call your mother. And thus the infamous comment, Mom, cancel our credit cards. We killed Osama bin Laden. Well, it was three subway stops away, and we made it there, and we got there, and there was, in fact, a ton of people. And there was a light podium, and one by one, people would get up, and they'd give a chant, and they would get a cheer, or someone would repeat the chant over and over. And then a guy jumped up there. He had dark curly hair, olive colored skin, and I thought, I held my breath for a minute. He ripped open his shirt and he said, I'm a Muslim, don't fear me. And he got a standing ovation. And I thought, moment of tolerance. And this went on for a couple more hours and it was great. Finally, we made it back to our hotel. The next day we got to the airport, went back to Minneapolis where we're living. And we're all said and done. The next day, Cole looked at me and said, that was, you know, I'm sure those guys that went to Europe with my school, that was pretty cool. But you and me, Dad, we have something we will remember forever. Thank you, Cole. That was great.
Thanks to Leif Wallin. You can hear his stories live at storytelling events in Bemidji from time to time, and we'll share more of them here on Stay Human. You're tuned to KAXE KBXE, streaming at KAXE.org. It's people-powered radio for the Northwoods, supported by the people who listen to it here and all around the world. If you're not already a member of this unique service, now would be a swell time for you to join us and help keep it going. If you don't happen to be driving at the moment, text the word DONATE to 218-326-1234. One little word, DONATE. Makes a big, big difference. Still to come in this hour, how to get the most out of an Airbnb, why you should be a big tipper, and how to reduce your risk if you happen to be traveling through Africa. Stay with us. You're tuned to the Travel Guide edition of Stay Human. I'm your tour guide, Michael Goldberg. My wife, Gail Otteson, and I like to take trips with friends, sometimes with friends who live in other parts of the country, so we only get to see them when we go somewhere together. Like any collaborative effort, each of us has our own particular thing to contribute. I get up early, so it's usually my privilege to go to the nearest bakery and come back with goodies for everybody to find when they wake up. But it could be that the most essential member of our travel team is Gail Otteson.
I'm the one who's willing to find housing for anywhere from 6 to 20 people, I think is the 18 maybe, is the most that we've traveled with. And it has its challenges, but the truth is I really love looking for housing. And so the secret is you have to spend hours and hours and hours and hours looking for the right place. And there are things I look for. How many bedrooms does it have? How many, you know, which, are there couples coming? Are there singles coming? Does somebody snore and they want a room by themselves? Things like that. But also, is it easy to get around from where we're staying? People can enjoy themselves. Is it a safe neighborhood? So I will get in touch with the person who owns the house when I find something that I think we will all like. And that relationship gives me all kinds of answers to my questions. Can teenagers walk around safely? Is there a grocery store close by where 18 people can just wander and, you know, find some late night snack? And so far, I can only think of one time where it turned out not to be, no, two times, three, where it's turned out not to be exactly what we wanted. I have found houses in Crete and Sicily and all over Mexico and Costa Rica. We found places in San Diego, Memphis, found places in New Orleans, Oakland once, all over the United States. And it's really the same thing I look for every time we go somewhere. Will people have fun staying? Oh, and is it nicer than the house I live in? That's also important to me. I either go through Airbnb or vacation rental by owner, Vrbo it's called, and there's always a get in touch with owner. And 99% of the time, they answer right away. And what you look for is it owned by an individual or is it owned by a company? If it's owned by a company, odds are that you're not going to get in touch with them immediately. But if it's owned by an individual, I have had wonderful experiences communicating with the people who own these buildings. And the best thing is if you get chatty with the person and ask them a few questions, you know, about themselves. And I don't know if it's an Airbnb thing, but most of the time people like to talk. Oh, you're having a family reunion and 15 people are showing up. Oh, that's so cool. I'm really glad you use our house. But for example, this is one of my favorite examples. We were in the northern Yucatan, a little way down a lonely beach on the Gulf of Mexico. And as it turned out, they were developing this beach, and we were the only house that had any people in it. And periodically, a man with a gun would walk up and down the beach and make sure that all these other houses that were unoccupied were okay. So that was a little strange. But then the only people who show up within miles came to the house right next door to ours. And they were loud, and they had a lot of kids and a few nannies. But the weird thing is, there was like an alley that went behind all these houses right next to the beach, and then the main, you know, and then a longer road that connected us to the main road. They started building a brick wall in the, like, at 6 o'clock in the morning to stop people from going down that alley to get to their houses because they wanted their kids to be able to go to the other piece of property right on the other side safely. Well, that's totally against the rules, totally against the rules. And I wrote to the woman who owned the house right away. I said, what's going on here? And she said, oh, this has been a big battle. They're really rich and they want to break all the rules. And so the six of us staying wanted to go into the town of Merida for the day. We walk out where our car is parked, and there's a film crew there, and there is a ratty truck with a rope tied to it, and it's pulling down this brick wall, and they're cheering because we walk out just as the wall is coming down. Luckily, one of us spoke Spanish, and they said, yes, this is going on an international YouTube channel that's helping us fight for our rights, you know, as equal Mexicans, that sort of thing. It was wonderful. So we had a very gossipy week with the woman who owned that house, who just thought, oh, they're right in the middle of it. And we were on the YouTube channel.
That's Gail Addison. She makes friends everywhere she goes. We got into organizing group trips partly because a week after the first time we went to the French Quarter Festival, I was at a KAXE gathering visiting with friends, telling them about the trip, and person after person said, hey, if you go again, let us know. We'd love to come along. We had a group join us for that festival just this last April, and soon afterwards, I told this story live at a storytelling afternoon at Clocko Brewing. I want to ask you all to raise a glass to Andy and Tasha Klocko and the brewers and the hardworking people here in the tap room. Live long and prosper. I hope you all remembered to tip them. Do we have any, like, big tippers here today? Oh, too bad. I thought about this subject of gratuities differently because my son lives in South Minneapolis, and he works in bars and restaurants. And when he started in this trade, and ever since, actually, anytime we go into a restaurant, at least one waitress rushes up to him, gives him a big hug, you know, and I'll probably sit at her table, too. But early on when he was doing that business, I would buy him lunch or dinner or some drinks and pay for it on my card, and he would glance at the receipt and drop a $10 bill or a $20 bill on the table. He said, Dad, these people, they really, really work hard. They're all underpaid. And it really makes a big difference. They will remember it. It makes a difference. Believe me, he said. So I believed him. And since then, I've always reached a little bit extra deep for a tip, which is probably why when I saw a guy walk up to the counter, put his hand in the tip jar and take out a few bills, I just went right up to him. This was in the French Market at the French Quarter Festival in New Orleans. And I should say, if you do not like food and you do not like music, that's not the scene for you. But otherwise, it's really a gas. And I was kind of in a, I guess you could say, expansive mood. And I went right up to him, big smile on my face, and I said, excuse me, did you just take money out of her tip jar? And he looked me right in the eye, open expression, not hostile at all. He said, well, I'll tell you. I went up and I ordered two muffalettas. It was $16 each. It's all prices on the board. And I gave her my credit card because I'm running a little low on cash. You know, with the credit cards now, they are charging you a 3.5% transaction fee for not using cash, using your credit card, even though the credit card company is only charging them like 1 or 1.5%. But anyway, I pay with my credit card, put a few bills in her tip jar. She rings it up and she says, that'll be $39.40. And I look up at the board. Two muffalettas, $16 each. That can't be right. That can't be right. Let me see the receipt. And she goes, oh, wait a minute. Two muffalettas. So with tax, that's $34.25. So that's what I paid. And then I'm standing at the counter waiting for my order to come up. I overhear other people ordering, and I look up at the board, and I'm doing the math in my head, and she keeps coming back with a higher number. And people are having a good time. They're at a party. They're not paying any attention. They just pay her whatever she says. And I'm thinking, wow, she's really got quite the scam going here. By this time, I'm walking with this guy back towards his table through the French Market, where sitting at the table is his traveling companion. She's got a big smile on her face, a couple of muffalettas in front of her. And he says, and then by the time I got back here, it occurred to me, why the heck should I tip her for ripping me off or trying to rip me off? And then he turns to his companion, and that's when I met this gentleman pointing at me. And there's introductions all around, and we're all having a swell time. Turns out they're from Minneapolis. And I sat down and visited with them a little while because I realized it's just not that often that I walk into a random disquisition on morality and deceit and justice, and he had something to say about all of that. And then I got up, I got myself a po' boy. I didn't even pay attention to what I paid for it. I mean, I was way too fessed to be stressed. And then the next day, I see them again. It's in the morning. I'm at the concert for the fabulous John Boutte. I work my way up close to the stage. I'm standing next to a fence, and I see that on the other side of the fence, there's an area of blankets and festival chairs, and they're down there in that area in the shade with a beautiful view of the stage. And I'm thinking, wow, they must have got here early to get such prime real estate. And then when the show is over, I glance over at them, and I see him folding up his blanket, and while he's doing this, somebody comes up to him from the crowd and puts an arm around his shoulder, and then somebody else comes up to him and shakes his hand. And while I'm watching him put his stuff together, there's like four or five people who come up to this guy to, you know, to talk to him or say something, I don't know what. And then she sees me watching this, and I say, you know, what's going on here? Is he like the mayor of Shady Spot here? And she says, oh, well, when we were all sitting down, a big guy walked into the area, and he just stood there, and he's blocking everybody's view. And my man here got up, smiled, talked to him, and made him go away. And all these other people just wanted to thank him for doing that. And one other thing you should know, she says to me, about that deal with the tip jar yesterday, he always walks around with a wad of single dollar bills in his pocket so that he can pass some out to anybody who asks. It doesn't matter, a busker, a beggar, this guy will go out of his way to drop a few bills in a hat. And I thought, okay, well, I think I would like to buy that guy a drink one of these times. And in fact, it could be that I'll run into him sometime in South Minneapolis. Maybe we'll get a table at Herkimer's or somewhere, you know, have a nice evening meal, talk about New Orleans, and then afterwards, we'll leave a big tip. So thank you all very much. Do it. Taste of New Orleans from Galactic with Alan Toussaint. We have one more story today, this from Corey Hamilton, safe at home in Bemidji.
I was doing a three-month trip in Southern Africa, and at one point, towards the end of the trip, I was in Namibia, and I met back up with this Dutch guy that I met in Cape Town, and him and his buddy asked me if I wanted to join them on a road trip to Luanda and Angola. And I said, sure, that sounds great. Let's do it. So we're on our way, and at one point we dropped off his buddy and he took a bus to Luanda. And then we went on our own little side quest, and we were driving along and it was getting pretty late. And we're like, oh, we need to find a place to camp. And he had this SUV with a tent on top, so it's called an Overlander. So there was an app that you can use, like Overlander, to look up different campsites, and we found one that was kind of on a desert beach. So we're like, yeah, sure. I mean, it's all we got, so we'll go there. We go there, and then the host, he's like, okay, yeah, you can come in the gate, just set up. And he came out there, and he's like, okay, yeah, here's the bathrooms, here's the water, if you need anything. He's like, oh, by the way, you'll find out tomorrow, but we do have a kind of an unorthodox pet, and it's a monkey. And he's like, okay, well, have a good night. And I was like, oh, okay, that's quite something to just drop on us and then say good night. So I was like, okay, sure, whatever. Then the next morning, woke up. We had part of the tent open, you know, just to get some airflow. And I hear like some noise on the tent, and the tent's moving around a little bit. I was like, what is that? And I look at the door, and it's the monkey, you know, playing with the tent and trying to get in. I was like, oh, that's right. There's a monkey here. That's a thing. So we just went on about our day, and then met with the host, and it was a German guy, and his partner was from Angola, a local Angolan. And they were telling us about the monkey, and they said, oh, yeah, we got this monkey at a ShopRite parking lot. And ShopRite is like a local grocery store chain. I was like, you bought your monkey at a grocery store parking lot? I was like, that sounds like the most Angolan thing I've ever heard in my life. And like, yeah, it's pretty typical for kids there to go over to the jungle, capture monkeys, and then bring them back and sell them. And, you know, for me, I was like, well, that sounds crazy. But, you know, that's their normal. So I was like, okay, sure, I guess you bought this monkey. And I mean, it was really cute. It was a really cute monkey. I'll give it that. It was about, they said it was less than 6 months old. And it would come up on my shoulder, and I let it climb up on me. And I was like, oh, this is cute. Like, I like this monkey. Like, this is kind of cool. And then, you know, the monkey went away for a little bit to go with the woman, and who was like the main caretaker and essentially the mother of the monkey at this point. And we were just cooking dinner, doing our own thing. And I went to go walk. I don't remember where I was walking. I was just walking. And I kind of look over, and the caretaker, she took away this toy that the monkey was playing with. And the monkey got very upset, and it decided to retaliate. And I became the target of that retaliation. So I was walking, and out of nowhere, the monkey came up behind me, grabbed my inner thigh, and then bit my leg, and then went away. And I was like, what in the world was that? And I like looked down, and I look up, and I see the monkey running, and then ran up into the tree. And I was like, the monkey just bit me. I was like, what? And then I was like, oh, you've got to be kidding me. So I look at it kind of towards the back part of my thigh, and it broke skin. So it wasn't a big bite, but it was hard enough that it actually broke skin. And I was like, oh, man, that's not good. You know, I was like, oh, man, it's like I got some blood. I should probably, you know, clean it up. So I got some alcohol from the guy and sprayed it, and it, you know, it stung quite a bit. So I was like, okay, well, is what it is. And he's like, oh, yeah, you know, you're the third person it's bit in under 2 months. And I was like, oh, well, that doesn't make me feel any better. I was like, that's actually more concerning. You know, the fact that it's going around biting people is not a good thing. I was like, oh, man. And then my mind just started going of like, oh, man, thinking about all the monkey diseases that exist. I was like, oh, man, what if this monkey has this? What if the monkey has that? And then it kind of hit me. I was like, what if it has the main thing that we have to worry about is rabies? And that stuck in my mind. I was like, oh, no, it's probably got rabies if it's bitten that many people in a short amount of time. And then me and my buddy were about to go to this canyon. And so we like laughed and went on our way. And he could tell I was really worried about it. So we stopped at a pharmacy, you know, just to see what their thoughts were. And they said, oh, yeah, that's not super common here in this part of the country, but here's some antibiotics and some, like, you know, insect bite cream. And I was like, insect bite cream isn't going to do anything. This is a monkey bite. And like, well, this is all we can really help you with. And I was like, well, okay, that's not very helpful. So kind of got the knowledge that the Angolan medical system wasn't the best. So I was like, okay, well, I'm really concerned about this, but I'm pretty hesitant to go in here. So I ended up waiting. So I continued on my journey through Angola. And I was like, well, I'm going to be back in Namibia soonish, so I'll just wait till I get back to Namibia. But as, you know, days went on, I was getting more and more concerned. And so partway on this road trip to Luanda, I messaged the caretakers of that campsite, and I was like, So, you know, I just wanted to know, have you gotten your monkey vaccinated? And they said, no. I was like, okay, well, I'd recommend you do. They said, I was like, are you going to get it tested? I know that that can be, you know, fatal for the monkey, but if it's bitten three people, you should probably make sure it's, you know, doesn't have anything. And they said, oh, it doesn't. I was like, okay, well, you know, there's a chance that it had rabies. And they said, no, 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 this monkey doesn't get rabies. I was like, what? What do you mean it doesn't get rabies? They said, no, no, this monkey doesn't get rabies. So, like, yeah, it can. I was like, you know, every mammal on this planet can get rabies. Some are more prone to it than others, but it is a possibility. They said, no, not this monkey, not our monkey. It will never get rabies. And I was like, okay, well, that's concerning because they have this delusion that their monkey can never have rabies. So I was like, well, no, I'm definitely going to go in when I get into Namibia because I'm very worried because I did a deep dive, you know, into the rabbit hole of research all about it because I was getting very anxious. And that's when I read, you know, multiple sources were telling me, yeah, it can be dormant for up to months. And I was like, oh, that's not good. And I actually met on my way when I went back to Namibia, I met someone else in the hostel and I was telling her about the story. And she's like, yeah, my friend actually died from that. I was like, what? She's like, yeah, my friend was over in Asia, Southeast Asia, and she got bit by a monkey. And she didn't think anything of it because she's like, well, I didn't have any symptoms, you know, like a week out. So she's like, oh, I'll be fine. Seven months later, she died of rabies. I was like, what? I was like, I mean, I don't mean to laugh, but like, I was like, oh my gosh, that's crazy. Like, so I was like, yeah, okay. You know, after reading these things and hearing this story, I was like, I'll go get the shot tomorrow. You know? So I ended up getting the shot in Namibia, and in Namibia, they were like, well, why do you need a rabies shot? I was like, well, I got bit by a monkey. And I had to tell them the whole story because they're like, there's no monkeys here in Namibia that would bite people. So, and then I had to get another shot over in South Africa. And then I had to tell them the whole story. And then coming back to the U.S. because, you know, it's every, you get it at 3 days and then 7 days and then another 7 days after that one and another 7 days after that one. So it's, I also learned in this process, the series of shots. Not just one. I was kind of hoping it was just be one, but it's this series. And I came back to the States, and it was actually really troublesome to get some here in the States because they're like, what? And they're like, you need to approve and get a physician note. And I was like, I don't know what to tell you. This isn't, it's not like I'm going to benefit, you know, I'm not going to like have like a, you know, weird trip or something from getting a rabies shot. Just give me a rabies shot. Why would I lie about something like this? So it was quite challenging, but I ended up finally getting the two last shots in the series here in the States. And so now, you know, it's still a possibility. I could get it, like a very small chance. They said that the two most important are the first two shots, but I'll know I'm 100% in the clear if I'm still alive this time next year.
Thanks to Corey Hamilton. We'll check in with you again in a few months just to make sure you're okay. And we'll check in again with Gail Addison, Leif Wallin, Marsh Muirhead, and Gail Blackmer. Thanks for coming along with us today. Hope you can tune in to Stay Human again this time next week for another hour of words and music. And when you go on your next trip, be sure to bring back stories to share. It's the only way to come home. We'll go out today with some Afropop from Flavor. Keep dancing, friends. Me.